Gerard Loughlin, professor in the Department of Theology and Religion at the University of Durham, is my latest nostalgia interviewee. We talk about how Gerard found himself studying theology and film. That's indeed how I know Gerard. And it also turns out that we both went to the same university, albeit at different times. We both studied in Lampeter. In Gerard's case, he studied English literature and theology. And we find out that his earliest memory, not from Lampeter, but from childhood, involves a cockroach, although actually it's his mother's memory, not his own. He talks about his family background and how many of his close friends went to university. We find out which teachers were the most influential, how he excelled when it came to writing long essays. Now, not only did Gerard watch movies, but he made films as a child. His school physics teacher inspired that interest, and it's the grammar of filmmaking that to this day is something that he's very keen to impart to his own students. We find out how Gerard ended up in academia. We find out that he did teacher training at one point. We talk about what it is that our students are thinking. We talk about the change in student culture and how in his Lampeter days, and this was pretty much my experience as well, the Arts Hall was the major cultural event on a Sunday night when films were shown. We talk about whether students were into politics in Gerard's student days. He talks about his involvement with CAFSOC and how he studied John Hick when he was in Cambridge. We talk about religious pluralism. On the whole, we find out whether Gerard's memories are positive rather than negative. We find out that he kept a diary for a short period. And at the very end of the interview, we discover whether Gerard is a looking back or a looking forward type of person. So join me. It was a great privilege to meet, for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews, Professor Gerard Loughlin from the University of Durham. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is my great pleasure this afternoon to have Professor Gerard Loughlin from Durham University. Of course, we've known each other quite a few times we've met, and we work very much in the same field. I think it's about 14 years since we last met, and that was at a conference in Copenhagen.
It was indeed, yes. Yeah. And which I have dim memories.
Yeah. Well, no.
But a very nice ones.
Yeah. Yes. And I remember your Alien Sex book came out just around the time that I got my PhD. So it was that period when there were only a handful of people, certainly in the UK, who seemed to be doing this, idiosyncratic might be the right word, but research in an area that nobody seemed to be doing 5 or 10 years earlier. So yes, was that something indeed that you got into sort of unexpectedly or through other routes?
I'm not quite sure now how I did get into doing theology and film. It probably comes out of a background in literature, you know, English literature and theology, which was my first degree, and a personal interest in film. And then I was aware of other people writing in that area, so I knew it could be done.
Yeah. No, and for me, I was working at one point in our university library in Lampeter. And I saw the odd book was sort of, you know, horror in film or religion in film, which was just a sort of study of particular 1960s paperback books about biblical epics. And I just thought, there's room to cultivate here. And it was around that time that I was starting to look at the whole intersection, the religion and the secular, and trying to find a way through that, which is what the PhD was on. And so hence the intersection.
Yes, indeed.
And of course, Lampeter was very much is a place very much close to your heart, because you were a student there back in the late 70s.
That's correct. Yeah. It was a long time ago. Yeah. And that's where I did English literature and theology, a joint honours degree.
Yeah.
And in ways that we've already mentioned, as it were, off microphone, very influential time. But then, I sailed on to do an MA in English literature, except that it had theology and religion in it. So I was looking at novels that were about religious faith and doubt.
Yeah.
So mainly 19th century novels, or novels of the turn of the 19th, 20th century.
Yeah. And do you feel, as I have really, that the time at Lampeter was foundational in ways that at the time you just thought you were doing your degree and following the path that is set out for you, but you know, I found decades on I still refer to some of that, you know, not necessarily literally in terms of the notes that I took, but the skills that I picked up there have directly impacted on some of the research I'm doing now, because if I'm doing something like, I don't know, life after death and film, then the life after death part was the training that I had as part of my BA and MA. And it, the way that things have come together, it kind of feels like I can almost go back to some of my contemporaries and people like Paul Badham and almost say to them, as I have done actually in the case of Paul, and say, you know, you may not recognise half of what I've written, but the other half is thanks to your great imagination and pedagogical, you know, skill. And it got me fascinated at a very young age in this rich area, indeed, quite quirky area of, you know, near-death experiences or whatever.
I think in my case, maybe the English literature side has been the more long-lasting. That's because though Paul Badham was very influential at the time when I was an undergraduate and sort of awakened my interest in philosophical theology, I did have a conversion, as it were, away from his approach to things when I was at Cambridge. And so my theological interests changed in a direction I would not have foreseen when I was at Lampeter. Whereas my interest in literature, perhaps that has remained more solidly in the area of things I learnt when I was at Lampeter.
Yeah. And going back a little bit further in terms of how, you know, what you remember doing as a child, how far can you go back in memory? What sort of childhood influences or memories, first memories, can you think of?
I have very very dim memories of childhood. And as I think a lot of people, you can't be certain where some of the memories you have are really your own or other people's memories that you've somehow incorporated.
Yeah.
So one memory, this is a very strange memory to have, but it's a memory that's really my mother's memory, which is when I was a young child. She found me one day happily playing with a cockroach. I have no memory of this, but it must be the way my mother reacted has given me not exactly a phobia in relation to insects, but I can now appreciate her horror at the time.
But there's almost a sort of, you can almost imagine a kind of, you know, in terms of your academic journey, or any, you know, sort of quite a few people I've spoken to, I think Clive Marsh had an early experience involving, I think, an apple and a worm, there's obviously something in what we do as children that sort of almost made us go on this particular, you know, without knowing perhaps where that was going to lead, but sort of foundational experiences.
But all of that, I'd have no timeline for childhood memories. Various memories of one kind or another, but exactly when they happened, it'd be hard put to say.
Were you also first generation university, or do you have is there a family connection there in terms of going to university? I mean, in my case, my sister and I were the first in our whole family to go to university, as we did in her case in the late 80s and mine in the early 90s. So was going to university something that was sort of like the obvious thing to do?
No, I don't think I was first generation. My father trained as a doctor. And though my mother didn't pursue, you know, she did, I think, spend 1 year at a university. This was back in Ireland. And of course, I had an uncle who was a university professor. I didn't know him very well, but he might have been the exception in the family. That was on my father's side of the family. And, you know, I've got cousins who also went to university. So I don't think you'd be right to say I was first generation.
No, because I was blessed to go to a church in Wales, as it was, school, where pretty much everyone went on to university, or it was just the assumption that's what we would do at the age of 18. It was only when I went to Lampeter that I discovered that that wasn't most people's, you know, expectation. And I realised just how privileged I was to be able to choose to go, you know, to get the grades to go where I wanted to go and flourish there for a number of years. And it was just sort of the expectation was that that's what you did at a certain age. And I think other people had quite different routes and different sort of life experiences. But was that the case, you know, in the 70s at Lampeter? I would imagine the percentage of 18-year-olds going to university was very low, you know, in the days when it was seen to be very sort of elitist and privileged to
I suppose that to do is, yes, I suppose that's the case. I don't, my recollection is that most of my close friends at school did go on to university. Yeah. But the school I was at, there wasn't an expectation that everybody would go on to university. And there was quite a large expectation that a certain number would not.
Yeah. It's funny how that works out. And also I went back to my school after getting my degree, and with a certain degree of trepidation, because on the one hand it felt, you know, like the boast, sort of, oh, look what I've just achieved. But also it's a way of almost saying, well, you may not have thought I had it in me, or, you know, who'd have thought that 5 or 6 years ago that I'd be doing what I'm doing now. But I think sometimes the teachers are really thrilled when they can say, well, you know, we sort of gave you a bit of a gentle push, and the rest of it's your doing. But they, you know, sometimes they inspired us, and certainly there are a whole range of teachers who, I think, sort of made me feel that this was something that I could cultivate and flourish at. But it does sometimes take, you know, it's the retrospective approach, I think, sometimes, when you then say, how did I get here, rather than where will I be in X number of years time. It's how did I get here? What, you know, is this a fluke? Is this a chance? Is this
well, it's certainly a fluke in my case, but but I'm just thinking of teachers inspiring me. They certainly would have been an inspiration to go on to university. Yeah. But it was certainly a teaching of a love of a subject. Yeah. And that the studying of texts was something worth doing. Yeah. So one teacher I do remember who was very influential, and again, this is on the literature side, was somebody by the name of Faith Tolkien at Oxford. And she did instill in myself and others a love of English literature and reading it and writing about it.
Yeah. And did you find then, when you were at university then, also that the research that you're doing now was sort of cemented, was it put in place due to your interactions with particular colleagues in either the English department or theology? Do you sort of look back and say, yes, it was because of that particular lecture or that particular book that you studied that you stayed in the profession? Because, you know, obviously there are many of us who, you know, so many people have said to me, oh, it's amazing that you've got to stay in university and you're doing all this great research. I would have done that if I'd had the chance. But, you know, sometimes there's a bit of luck.
I think I'm in the university still because of a lack of imagination. I just couldn't imagine doing anything else. Yeah. Or I was so I do remember people who told me that I wasn't cut out for an academic. Somebody at Lambton, in fact, who we mentioned.
It is interesting,
told me that. But other people, Paul Bowden was one, obviously had more faith in my ability to do it. I was thinking recently, actually, one of the things I used to do and I was quite good at was writing essays. In which I would get good marks. But in my time, none of the final assessment was done through essay work. It was all exams, at which I was less good.
Yeah.
But I also remember that I wrote essays that were very long. So there cannot have been a word limit. Today, I would thoroughly disapprove of not having a word limit. Yeah.
Well, of course, when you're the marker,
yes.
This is completely different.
Well,
this is the thing in this profession. It's like I've been at conferences when, you know, academics, who we assume, say to their students,
yes,
you know, don't go over a certain threshold, and we will penalise you if you do. At conferences, we'll go hideously over time. But you know, as an undergraduate, I was often going to David Selwyn and others and say, you know, excuse me, you know, I know it's only supposed to be 5,000 words, but it might be closer to 6. And, you know, in many cases in those days, they were like, well, as long as it's a good piece of work, we're not going to count the words.
Yes,
but these days, I think we are a bit more.
And I realised I was indulged. The only excuse might be that there were fewer students in the department at Lambton than we have in Durham.
No, but it feels not so much a conveyor belt, but it does feel that sometimes these days, if we ask for a certain, you know, a certain threshold to be reached, you know, we do tend to sort of say, well, you know, if we ask for 3,000 words and you write 5,000, you've written a different form of assessment.
And there is a skill in learning how to write to the word limit, and often, nearly always, things are improved for being shorter.
And some students do really well at 1,500 word essays, and they can't do the 3,000 ones. and others who just say, I cannot condense my material into this, and I'm worried about what I'm going to leave out of it. So again, it's very much a skill, and
yes,
it almost feels, if anyone wants to go into the legal profession, I always feel that sometimes, you know, university, the regulations are actually quite accommodating in that regard, because you have to be really precise, and you don't have the indulgence of just saying, I'll write and I'll stop when I'm ready to, rather than because there's a prescription in a number of words. But no, that was my experience as well. Yeah, writing essays and thinking, oh, I knew nothing about this topic a week ago, and now I feel like I'm a mini expert.
Yeah, I don't know if I well, as I often say to students, the one thing I did learn was how little I knew. And it was only when I finished the degree that I realised I was at a point where I was ready to start a degree.
No, exactly. And I think also that your experience was similar to mine of staying in the same place, but then saying, OK, well, I feel I've just about got to grips with the fundamentals.
Yes.
I prove that I can do it, but I feel that the journey has only just begun.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm still on that trajectory, I think. I don't feel, you know, I see my students and in many ways see that I'm... you know, sharing a journey with them in many cases, rather than that, you know, I'm necessarily saying I'm the expert. It's more a case of, well, you know, the days when you say this is the answer, you know, you're in the wrong job, and the students teach me as much as I teach them. Yeah. What about other things that you enjoyed doing as a child? Because obviously you have an interest. These, you know, film is obviously something that's very key to much of your research over the years. But you know, that or music, anything from childhood that you can say, yes, this was something that has stayed with you all these years.
I suppose I can confess that I did have an interest in films as a child and in making them. Yes, those are the days of Super 8. I don't know if you standard 8 films, and you would a little camera, and you would take a 3.5 minute. That's how much celluloid you had in a canister, and then you could send it off for processing. And so I did learn, around to how to film and get the film back and edit and put them into little stories and things. Which I used to get my siblings to sometimes engage in little dramas.
And do they still exist? Do you still have these recordings?
They do still exist, yes.
Yeah.
Some of them have been transferred to a digital format.
Yeah.
But actually, I couldn't quite say where they are at present.
Yeah.
And I never got to the stage of being able to make sound films. There was one film that we did with sound. So myself and a school friend, we made a short film. That was an animation film with sort of stop action motion. The film itself only lasted for about 5 minutes, but it took months sort of working together after school to actually make it.
Yeah.
And that does remind me, we did have, this was, at secondary school, there was a very good physics teacher who encouraged this interest in filmmaking.
Yeah. Gosh, so that was, it's those sort of quirky experiences, isn't it, that sometimes somebody will, you know, almost like a teacher will accidentally say something that makes you think, oh, I could do that. And, you know, whether it's model railways or whether it's writing short stories or creative fiction, and suddenly you've suddenly find 20 years on that you have this flair that somebody has cultivated. But I didn't realise that you made films rather than studied them. That's really impressive, actually, because my experience is very much at university I started watching films. I really had none of those sort of experiences prior to that. So my research in religion and film came literally a matter of years after I discovered that film was something that I could engage with as a very different sort of resource to academic books and journals, which obviously you still use, and the PhD that I did was completely modelled on not just the films themselves, but what people were saying about them and the critics were saying about them, Redemption or whatever it might have been that I was focusing on. But to make a film, that's a real skill set, which probably is a good counterpoint to some of the written work that obviously academic study consists of.
So, yeah, as you say, there's the interest in the content of films and, you know, what they're trying to convey in terms of meaning and so forth, or the feelings they create in an audience. But there's also that I have that interest in the technical means by which the film is put together, and do try and encourage that in students to as well understand the grammar of filmmaking and how that can then be used to articulate various.
And that does come out in your research, actually. And I've seen that very much in what you've written about Tarkovsky or whoever, because I remember I tell my students sometimes films are not just about narrative, films are not just about story, so don't just give me the synopsis of a plot. But then I'm sometimes aware that I myself sometimes fall a little bit too much into that approach at the expense of the practical, you know, the film study side, shall we say, of a film viewing. So I'm aware of that tension, and I sometimes feel that I have to almost stop myself from trying to make everything into a narrative. Because that obviously is one vital, but not necessary. And that's what people in many of the people in religion and film tend to do, of course, or we're accused of doing sometimes. We say, oh, that plot is very Christological, but just finding parallels with the New Testament story. And I say to my students, don't go down that path. But back in my mind, it's that fear that maybe I have slightly slipped into that.
Well, of course, the narratives are important, and that's one of the difficulties, I think, of writing about film, to get all that down on the page so that... the reader can understand it. But you're correct that often an accusation I may have made it of others myself, that they're just using the film to illustrate a theological idea and so forth. And I've tried to avoid that, though I know there are people who think I've fallen into the same error.
Yeah. What about music when you were young? Because you've probably heard me in some of the other interviews as well talking very much about the influence that the charts had on me growing up. Because I was never that sort of child who sort of seemed to be, inverted commas, cool, or sort of, you know, nobody would sort of look at me and say, he sort of like, is the way he dresses, or the way he, you know, sort of, I was never one of the in crowd, as it were. But I had this strange interest, not so much in the music per se, but the context in which it appeared, which would often be on the radio. So it was more sort of the fact that it was on the radio and a particular presenter would sort of almost flag this up and get excited about it. That worked its magic on me. It wasn't the records themselves. It was the fact that those records were played on the radio. But the charts was a way in which that was all sort of given its fullest expression every week. But did you have any sort of similar experiences there?
I can't say that music was such an important area. Of course, I was aware of popular music, and as I got older, did listen to it, and you had to listen to a certain amount, so you could talk about it with friends in school, and they would tell you about what they were interested in. And I do remember that when I first got a cassette recorder, and recording music off the radio, and making a sort of... what would you call it? A song track or song?
Yes, I guess. You could edit often, if you had those...
And the thing was to edit it so you could get rid of the conversation and just have a seamless track of music. Much easier to do these days.
No, it is. But also, I used to keep in those presenters' voices, thinking that I would subsequently get rid of them and have this perfect tape. But realised that there was the bits in between. Like people sometimes say that the adverts are the best bits in the old films they used to record, because that would tell you more about the time and place. And it's like those were the things that used to galvanise us as children. But those voices, to have a little bit of Jimmy Young or a little bit of Terry Wogan or whoever, that would sort of immediately take me back to, yes, that was January
93. But that's an accident of,
yes,
as it were.
Yeah. It was
the techniques, but completely, now they are more interesting, as you say.
Yeah. Yeah, so interesting by accident. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I'm also thinking that, of course, my parents disapproved of popular music, pop music. Yeah. So it was something you had to sort of listen to, and you couldn't play it too loud.
No, well, in my case, my parents really liked the pop music of their generation, late 50s, early 60s, but kind of thought that, as no doubt their parents thought about their own musical interests, by the time in the early 80s, they thought, it's all a little bit, you know, they're not wearing suits, are they? And sort of, you know, they're not properly dressed on television. If you were on television, you'd be wearing a smart suit sort of thing. And so there was always that sense that my generation's music, and the same with my children, I'm sure. I have no interest in what's around at the moment, but they will when they're older, they will find their own niche.
Well, we used to used to listen to things like Top of the Pops on television and Top whatever it was on the radio. And we got a bit older, the old Grey Whistle Test on BBC Two. But also, I know a lot of music of the period when I was growing up, I've sort of discovered later on, so in a more archival kind of way.
And, yeah. No, that's interesting. And do you feel in that sense that the things that you were listening to then have sort of stayed with you? I mean, some people say to me about film, oh, why would you watch a film that, you know, if you've seen it, once you've seen it, why would you go back to it? Which is absurd. But you wouldn't say to somebody, oh, if you like that Beatles song, therefore, why would you listen? You know, if you like Penny Lane, well, why would you listen to it again? You've heard it once and you like it. And often you need to go back to something and it gives you another grounding and it gives you another sort of sense of, you know, something is really good. It also may lower or raise your mood for, you know, in whatever context. So in that sense, do you find that those formative influences have kind of stayed with you, or do you see them very much as things that were useful at a particular time but then you moved on to loftier
pursuits? I think it's the latter. I don't remember too many of the pop stars or musicians that I used to listen to. And somebody like, say, David Bowie is somebody, of course I did hear the music at the time, but it's something I've come to appreciate much more in the last 20 years.
No, and often that gives it stability and substance, doesn't it? That sometimes when, you know, something outside of its time, when you can be a bit more critical of it, I guess it can work with anything, even in terms of politically or, any, you know, in terms of some of the sort of debates that we have in the field of theology. You know, sometimes reflecting on that 10 or 20 years later, when you see the wider context within it emerged, seems to have more gravitas than almost sort of saying this is ephemeral, this is what's happening now. I sometimes find myself, even with in politics, sometimes I find those sort of leadership contests of yesteryear far more exciting now, in the sense of what might have been and who was elected instead of that person, yes, and indeed, whatever, far more influential now than at the time. And it's more a case of, we don't want that person because they, you know, this person's views are closer to the grassroots of whichever party. And 20 years on, you think, you know, that the whole what if, which of course is obviously related to the nostalgia enterprise. So, yeah, do you find that in other contexts as well, then, whether politics or in terms of religion, that sort of sense that certain things matter because you can't shake them 10 or 20 years on? It's more a case of this is unresolved, you know, at least for yourself, and maybe other people may have moved on and forgotten about that particular crisis or problem or threat or whatever it might have been. Do things like that niggle away at you many years after the happening?
I can't think of things in quite that way. Nothing comes to mind. I was understanding more in terms of, you know, going back and go back to a film that you saw, yeah, and then you begin to study it and learn about it in its context. So David Bowie, an example, you know, looking at The Man Who Fell to Earth by Nicholas Roeg.
Yes.
So you can go and do a lot of research and recreating the social world out of which that film came, and so exploring the complexities of the film.
Yeah. And what about entering academia? I mean, in a way, we've covered this already, but was this something that you, was there a point when you were at university when you thought this could be a career, or was it something that you fell into almost sort of accidentally? You know, how did you end up in the profession that you're in now? Because you were at Newcastle before coming to Durham, and I get the sense, you know, obviously you've been in this profession a long time, but was there almost an inevitability about it?
I don't know if there was an inevitability, but it's certainly, I'm one of those people who's never lived outside of the educational system.
Same here.
From when I entered it, which, given the fact that I hated school, actually, when I was young, is a bit bizarre, isn't it? Yeah. But I did love university, and it's the opportunity to study that university opened up. Yeah. And learning that I could write in the subject of theology, and that I could write articles that people were prepared to publish, and that I enjoyed doing that, and wanted to go on doing it, meant that I really did want to have a pursue, if possible, a university career, which I was lucky enough to do. There were a few years when I did do teacher training, as a number of people did, which probably did help get a job, though whether it helped me teach, I'm not sure.
Well, that's one thing I didn't do, and I wonder whether that would have been an advantage, because in a way I learned the hard way. I mean, obviously I'm dealing with students who want to be there. If they don't want to learn, then they're adults, they shouldn't be in the classroom. But a teaching route, which many of my peers indeed at Kent have done, is foundational in many ways, because you start to learn not just the content, you know, how to disseminate the content of your research, but how to do it in a way that can make an audience of students really sort of be inspired by what you're doing. And that's something which I learned, took me a good few years. I never knew the difference between lectures and seminars, for example. I would always sort of, whether it was a lecture or a seminar, I always felt that I needed to impart information, because that was my job. Only in later years did I start to feel that it was okay to let the students contribute, because I was always worried that they might think, well, we need a steer. So I'd be oversteering.
Yes.
But did the PGC help you in terms of...
Well, because PGC lecturing? Was training really for secondary school teaching, so it's a different set of skills to be able to teach, you know, a group of 30 kids at different ages, and you're learning the teaching course the different age ranges from when they first entered secondary school up to sixth form. Yeah. But obviously I did enjoy, when I did get to teaching, it was teaching sixth form as I enjoyed most, because that's when you could had people who were really interested in the subject.
And that's often the way, isn't it? That sometimes when somebody says this clicks, in fact, we've got one of my former both BA and MA students at Kent is now at Durham doing a PhD, and I once sent an email to I said in class once, I was teaching the modern theology course, and I said, does anybody sort of wake up at 3 a.m. sometimes and feel that if I'm talking about Bultmann or myth or whatever it might be, or Karl Barth, do you sort of wake up and feel these questions sort of really affect you, or are you just doing this for credit sort of thing? And no one spoke. Because I wasn't sure if I was connecting with the students. And anyway, this student then emailed me a few days later. She said, I really wanted to say yes, but because no one else put their hand up and nobody else looked like they were going to do so, I would have felt a bit, you know, sort of, I would have stood out and it would have embarrassed me. So, and she said, that's why I'm doing this, and I never want to stop learning. So I was really pleased for her, because I thought, well, that in a way, that was enough. You know,
indeed,
Everyone's there for their own reasons, and it's okay to do a degree to get, you know, you want to get that bit of paper at the end of it. But in a way, from my point of view, I kind of needed to know whether they just wanted me to give them information so they could go and regurgitate it, or whether they were going to be so inspired, irrespective of whether they had an essay to write on this topic, to go and research it more fully. And
well, you often do feel that people are wanting to be told what it is that you want them to write, which is not what you want them to do. Yeah. You want them to think for themselves and then... Yeah. Surprise you. I do realise the problem is that then they will write something and you'll say, no, that's not it. And they're thinking, why is it not it? So a set of skills to learn there. But of course, that's one of the big difference between certainly when I was an undergraduate and today, we had no fees to pay.
Yeah. Same here.
And we had a grant to support us. So it's not saying my parents didn't support me a bit as well, but certainly the bulk of it was coming from the state, and it was a very different
and for that
approach
reason,
to education, I think, than we have.
And today. You probably found it at Lampeter as well, that for that reason, many students would travel much further than they do now. I mean, in my latter years at Lampeter, I might ask the students, where have you travelled from? And they'd say, well, we went to the local comprehensive school. Whereas in my day, most of the students seemed to be from London and the South East, or certainly they travelled a long distance, because the grant in those days applied wherever you went. And if people didn't have jobs or family commitments, or they didn't need to stay at home because they had a part-time Saturday job or something like that, then it meant that they could really say, well, either A wants to get as far away as they could from their home, or they thought the degree actually looked rather good, or the place looked rather good. So Lampeter sort of attracted people who were prepared to make that, you know, go the extra mile or several miles in a town
without
a train centre. Yeah, because once they were there, they thought, well, you know, the journey here was worth it, because now we're here, we're happy to stay for as long as it takes. Mm. And I in that sense feel I had a very privileged education, but. The university culture has changed very much, and now that the students are paying the fees, in many cases, of course, the university degree is not their full-time occupation. Many of them have other things going on.
Yes, indeed, and it is amazing how they manage to combine both academic study and a paid job, which is very difficult.
Yeah. And what about other things that were going on at university when you were there in the late 70s were anything from sports, film. I mean, I assume the arts all showed films in those days.
Well, I think both of you, both of us, have experienced the the arts hall and the showing of films. So that Lampeter, of course, in the middle, as of nowhere in some respects, the major cultural events were the Sunday night film showing, where you got a Hollywood film usually from a few years previously. And then there was the Wednesday night film showing. I don't know if you had that, which was
We might have done that, actually.
That was the arts film. So that's where you got to see films of maybe 20, 30, 40 years previously, black and white often, European films. So that was much smaller audience. On Sunday nights, most of the college was present. I remember that this was the days before people had private computers, personal computers. Yeah. You either went to see the film, there was a small television room, I remember, or maybe two, showing different channels, so you could go and watch television. But the room would only hold about 20 people or something. Yeah.
No, and
so they were important, and it was, I suppose, a film education. It was a regular during term time.
But it was at the Arts Hall in Lampeter that I saw, at the age of 17, at a new entrance conference, Taxi Driver. And the fact that I did a PhD, which largely looked at Taxi Driver just a few years later, I'm sure, was not unrelated, and A Clockwork Orange.
So were they Sunday night showings, or were they...?
Well, the New Entrant Conference was in a week, so that was just for us as New Ents.
Oh, I see, yes.
But The Clockwork Orange was shown on a Tuesday night, and it was in the January of my first year, so early 92. And I don't know where the copy had come from, because obviously Kubrick had banned the film, but there was a... I don't know if I'd even heard of the film before it was shown, but
interesting,
of course it was the event, shall we say, that everybody went because it was like, oh, well, this is not something we could watch elsewhere. And that stayed with me, and I think it was a very packed arts hall. I think people had to bring in their own chairs because they ran out of spaces. And it was, remarkable, And the Exorcist was shown as well. Again, that was banned from home entertainment, shall we say. You could see it at the cinema. But again, it was a place that, despite its lack of a cinema and the fact that it was far away from many other bigger towns and cities... did have quite a... For me, I associated very much with the place where I saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's the place where I saw lots of silly, forgettable Hollywood films, which I often, to this day, still put up as my sort of film of the day on Facebook, but also some of those groundbreaking films. Casablanca was one that I saw, and I wonder if that might even be the first and only time that I've seen the film in its entirety. It was in the Lampeter Arts Hall. One Sunday night, I think, in that case. Yeah. Mm. So that's nice to think, actually, that... Although you were there before me, it's sort of that culture hadn't really changed. That was something that obviously was very much part of the tradition of Lampeter, rather than something that was just sort of we had an Ents person who was into film. It wasn't a short lived.
Because these were the days when films arrived on canisters; they had to be put on real projectors, and sometimes I remember once there was they didn't have the right lens, so a widescreen film was actually all very squashed up. But I presume it's changed today when everybody can watch whatever they like on their phone and their personal computer.
So I think the magic, people have more than once referred to my university days as the golden age, in a way, of Lampeter. I can't talk about previous generations, but certainly afterwards, I think I was there at the right time. Certainly for me, I don't regret not being there a decade later, let's put it that way. Yeah. What about other things? Because I suppose, for me, the 1992 general election was the first election I voted in, but late 70s, I don't know. Was politics a big... Were students into politics? I didn't get the sense in the 90s people were super... I mean, the poll tax preceded my time at university, but was there a real sort of sense where people going on demos, on campaigns? Did people get excited about elections?
There was politics at Lampeter. I was very unpolitical. Perhaps I still am, but I was certainly less political than I am now, or I'm now more political than I was then. But the major events, I think, were to do with Welsh nationalism at the time, to do with revival of the Welsh language and the idea that English would not just be the dominant language in the college. And so there were protests about that, I think, when I was there, and maybe even a few sit-ins of some officers or other. I have very vague memories. As I say, it wasn't something with which I was directly involved or understood.
Yeah.
But that that was happening at the time.
Yeah. And what about other background influences? I say background in the sense that were there any other things that you particularly remember from your time at university where you can say maybe to do with something on the radio or some particular current affairs event or something to do with the field of theology or religious studies? Or was there anything that you used to look back and say that defined the time? I mean, when I was an undergraduate, we had the in the Church of England Women Priests. That was, I think, in November 92. And that was we'd had a lecture with Paul Badham on the ordination of women to the priesthood that very day. I'm sure that was just a coincidence. Mm. But it felt like sort of we had the lecture in the morning and I was watching. I think it was, I can even remember, Francine Stock, BBC Two, for, you know, following what was going on in the General Synod in the afternoon. But that seemed quite a momentous thing to be happening. It had nothing specifically to do with Lampeter, although many of the Church in Wales later gatherings were indeed in Lampeter during our Easter vacations and so on. But anything similar to that in your Lampeter days?
I can't remember any specific events. I mean, obviously, I was in, you know, very much involved with the CathSoc, the Catholic Society, Student Society, and that was very much involved with the local parish in the town as well. So interesting what was happening in the Catholic Church. Beginning to read, I suppose, what we'd think of today as liberal Catholic theologians, people like Hans Küng.
Yeah. I met him at Lampeter, actually.
Did you?
Many years later. This would have been in about 2000, maybe late 90s, maybe about 98. Yeah, he came and he gave a talk, and it was, and John Hick as well gave a talk. Again, completely in the Canterbury building, I seem to recall. Yeah, huge.
I suppose maybe Kung was more of an influence. Yes, I suppose the end of my time at Lampeter, maybe the beginning of my time in Cambridge. And that, I never met Kung, but that's where I did hear him speak when he came to Cambridge. 1 year. But that's interesting that
he did. It would have been around, yes, late 90s. Mm. And John Hick as well met on a number of occasions. And we were all terribly excited because we were studying him.
Of course.
With Paul Badham and then the person we were studying. But I think actually, I remember Paul Badham joking that he said, so the lecture on religious pluralism, John Hick and pluralism, will be given by John Hick. And we all laughed. And indeed, this was done. And actually, he made it coincide with our lecture time. And there were only about 20 of us in the class. And we used to have it in the seminar room in the Bryngillas in the theology building. But because obviously we were expecting a larger audience, we was in like the Canterbury building. And you know, everybody came, all from the whole university staff and students, and it was very much an event. And I think John Hick is someone that you certainly have met.
Well, of course, because of Paul Badham, he did introduce us as undergraduates to John Hick's work, and then that did influence me at the time. So, as you perhaps know, I went on to Cambridge to do my PhD on John Hick's theology.
Oh,
so I didn't meet John Hick until I actually started to study him at doctoral level. So I was remarkably, as it seemed to some people, one of two people studying John Hick at Cambridge at the same time. Yeah. We both began in the same year.
And I think Hick was someone who, he wrote an autobiography in later years, I remember that, and I thought not many theologians, you know, it was interesting that he was then deemed, obviously, to be obviously I know he died in about 2012, but he was sort of somebody who had a real following and a real sense that, you know, Hick had influenced a number of generations.
Yes.
You know, Paul Badham obviously being the obvious case in point.
Yeah. Well, I earlier referred to Myers' work conversion theologically. So, as I began as a great proponent of Hick's view of things, but ended by being very critical of his work.
Yeah.
And so it is strange that now here, say at Durham, I don't think Hick gets taught in the degree program here to any great extent. Of course, he's still, I think, being taught at sixth form level. And of course, one of the great strengths, but maybe a weakness as well, of his writing is very clear and very easy to grasp arguments. I say weakness because I think the more you study the arguments, the more puzzling they become.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was the right person for me at the right time.
Yes, I think it was the same for me, because I had Chris Arthur as well who taught me, and he had a very different take on pluralism. And I know Clive Marsh has had similar debates with John Lydon in the sense of, you know, the category of religion and, you know, the fact that religion is a broad, as is theology, there are lots of different theologies rather than a sort of generic type. And I think that, but John Hick was exciting at a certain time because he gave this talk, which effectively, and I'm not doing him great service here, but effectively saying that regardless of whether you're Christian, Jew, or Muslim, you were kind of all worshipping the same thing. And at the time, that felt like a really positive thing because it was really suggesting that we had all this in common. But I think in later years, it somehow felt that almost sort of glossed over the specificities of particular traditions and almost said, you know, you're the same as somebody else. When they say, no, we have our own distinct heritage. Mm. But at the time, as an idea, as an abstract idea, it seemed to really fit and it ticked a box. And as an undergraduate learning about theology, it seemed a really clever idea. But I think it was just that... In later years, certainly when you sort of look at some of the pluses and minuses of multiculturalism, somehow that particular paradigm doesn't always fit. But the fact is, whether you agree with it or not, as an idea, I think that it was one that we could all say, you know, you don't have to agree with it, but you can at least see that it was.
And of course, it began to open up departments, very traditional departments of theology to the need to study other religious traditions as well. And, of course, that was most prominent in places like the University of Birmingham where Hick had taught. So it's sometimes a direct and sometimes an indirect sort of beginning to pluralise discipline.
Some more, should we say, philosophically based questions just to start to round off. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones over the broad sweep of your life? Actually, one thing I didn't ask you earlier on is where you were born, which part of the country that you you hail from.
Ah, yes, this is always a difficult question to answer in that there's no one bit of the country I hail from. I was, because my parents are both from the west coast of Ireland, from near Galway. And then they grew up, and that's where they met, in the city of Galway. But I was born shortly after they came to England, as I was born in Liverpool, which I have absolutely no memory. And I'm not even certain at what point they left Liverpool. And then, because my father worked in the health service, well, I suppose there's not a reason, but he was in the health service. And when we were growing up, he moved jobs every... 4-6 years, so I sort of grown up in the Midlands, really, that I remember. Mansfield, Milton Mowbray, and then Oxford. We lived just outside of Oxford, and after that comes Lampeter, Cambridge, and now the North East.
Wow. I mean, that question about whether memories are predominantly positive, I find this a fascinating question, because, not least because of my work in nostalgia, there's that, you know, I'm always asking myself as well, am I glossing over everything? You know, I often, in terms of the questions that I've asked you, obviously I focused a lot on university experiences, but I know from my diaries at the time, you know, they were stressful periods in many ways, but because maybe the outcome was good, you know, the degree went well and I went on to further study and indeed stayed in this profession, I sort of, it ticks, you know, all the boxes are ticked, but you know, sometimes when I look back at those individual diary entries, I sometimes think, well, actually, you know, there were particular days here when it was pretty horrible. But somehow I'm in my own mind trying to work out sometimes whether I'm being quite discerning in what I remember. But it's an impossible question to ask, really. But would you say that the memories on the whole are positive ones? Or indeed, can you be nostalgic about negative experiences?
It's an interesting question. I think I am, on the whole, they're positive. But that's probably because I'm... more readily bring the positive to mind. Yeah, I mean, if I push myself, I could think of negative memories. And for the short few years when I did keep a diary, yes, things might look more... At the time, they seemed bleaker, as it were. Yeah. But with distance, they weren't really that bleak. I think when you're younger and you write up a diary, it sort of dramatises things in a way that with... distance and age, they become less pressing in a way. And obviously, I think this must be a reflection both of, I suppose, in the whole comfortable upbringing and also being in a comfortable place at present. That must colour
absolutely
what the past seems like.
Would you say that you have fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? If you had dreams, particular dreams when you were young, but you know, do you entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life that, you know, maybe in keeping with what you dreamt about doing at school or at university?
I think I would say that I haven't. I don't have a sense that there are things that I haven't fulfilled or that I haven't done, and I'm happy with the things that I have done. But obviously, they could all have been done better, and there'd be a few things that I might regret having done. But there's no point on dwelling on those.
No, indeed, yeah. And last couple of questions: are you in touch with friends from your past? I guess that's Lampeter, I guess, is the obvious question. But, you know, or at school, are you still in contact with people from those days? I suppose virtually through things like Facebook, I guess it's possible to sustain these sort of friendships.
So over the years, friends sometimes drop away in a way. So as I said to you earlier, before we started this conversation, there's one person I'm still in touch with from Lampeter days. And that was, I haven't seen him for a long time, but Facebook makes it possible to have a connection again.
No, and social media, you're absolutely right. It strangely enables those conversations just to carry on in some cases from where we left off. Of course, in some cases you might say that person really is, you know, just as eccentric or just as in some cases problematic as they were then, but in a funny way it kind of means that we all move on in different ways. But
yes, indeed, that's it. So occasionally, you know, you come across somebody you used to know and you find they've been living a life that you neither of you would have expected when you knew each other.
And it's exciting, and sometimes of course it works both ways, that you want to have their life and they want yours. And you say, please, you know, don't indulge me. Would you say finally that you're a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I do looking back sometimes. It's dim, and I'm a sort of, I don't know, it wouldn't be quite right to say I live in the present, but the future is also kind of shadowy in a sense. I don't wait for it to arrive.
And of course, in many cases, I suppose a lot of people answer by saying, well, I live in the present moment, but, you know, as a theologian, certainly, I suppose my work on nostalgia plus all the eschatology work that I've done previously, which sort of doesn't make sense, but, you know, sometimes I feel that I find those sort of past and future questions almost to be the same ones. You know, the sense that are we trying to make the future a continuation of something that maybe in a sort of prelapsarian sense we once thought was a golden age, or maybe not, or we're just escaping from it, or maybe we don't think long term. I think maybe it's probably unhealthy sometimes to have those, you know, plans that are too long drawn out, because we're never always going to meet those expectations.
Yeah, I think I try to just find, I'm not very good at doing it, but just trying to find the blessing that comes in the present moment. And appreciate it when it does arrive.
Gerald, it has been wonderful to catch up with you this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.